So we le left off last week with what verse in 20?
Well, I actually got caught up on my editing, believe it or not,
Oh, good.
yesterday or whenever. Yeah, I think I finished last week's yesterday. But the week before that, you ended by saying we need to talk about the key and the chain. And last week we didn't talk about the key and the chain.
Yeah, that's why last week I thought we were still on 19.
Yeah.
I just didn't remember specifically where.
I got quite caught up in the key and the chain,
Yeah,
taking notes, and it started growing pretty fast in my head because of people's comments, and then comparing it with other concepts, and I ended up with quite a few notes on that.
well, why don't you share that with us?
This is based on verse one, correct?
Yes, verse 1 and 3.
That's chapter 20, right?
Chapter 20.
Yes.
All right.
Of course, the key is in verse one. The abyss is in 1 and 3. And the, well, yeah, the 1 to 3 is all sort of one thing. Let me just read some of my notes here. It'd be easier than trying to summarize them. I said, note how previously this key had been received by possibly the same entity, Satan, who is now being bound. However, it is not clear that the key is actually used at this point. That's something I was observing when I was looking at it. It says the angel came down with a key, but it doesn't say he used the key. He just had the key, which I think might be significant.
How do you reckon with locked? He locked and sealed it over him.
Well, I'm not sure mine says lock. Mine says he shut it and sealed it over him. You could shut the abyss without a key. I mean, you could shut a door without a key. And I'm not saying it's not used. I'm just saying it's not overtly used, which could leave things open for other potential meanings or not. Anyway, just an observation.
Yeah.
Well,
This angel coming down, likely Jesus at his second coming, now exercises control of this key. The connection for understanding the possible nature of this key is its association with chaos, which you had a really good discussion on that. The meaning of the word abyss, which is chaos. In Revelation 9:1, chaos is further unleashed on the earth by Satan after it was originally contained at the creation of this world by the word of God. And this is where suddenly I started seeing connections to the word. The key and the word may relate to each other. So here we see once again that the same entity named Word, which is previous in this chapter, verse 13, now who has also become flesh or one with humanity, here he is containing chaos. Once again, dealing with the abyss of darkness as he did previously at creation. If the key represents involvement in restraining or releasing chaos, then binding Satan temporarily sets things up for use of the key later in verse 3, when he must be released by use of this key. So he's binding chaos like he did at creation, but then 1,000 years later, it's released again, which actually would parallel 9 verse 1. In a very real sense, Christ has always himself been the key to God's dealing with the chaos that originally resulted from Lucifer's rebellion in heaven before the creation of this world. God's Christ is the key to accomplishing God's salvation. As Michael, who is like God, the Son of God, fought against the dragon accuser, Satan, to defend God's reputation. At the creation of this planet, it was God's Christ, the Word of God, pre-incarnate, who confronted the abyss and darkness with the breath, word of truth, light, and the authentic power of love. From this perspective, in a sense, when the key Son of God became incarnate in human flesh, he was allowed to be accessed by the star fallen from heaven, who is the author of chaos, darkness, and devastation. When Christ returns the second time, he is no longer under the oppression of Satan and exercises control to eliminate chaos once again, but not for the final time, as that comes in the next chapter. Key may also be perceived as a pivotal action that alters everyone's perspective of reality. In chapter 9, Satan, the Antichrist, launches an all-out assault on how everyone perceives God and reality. While here, that false narrative is overturned and reversed by the Epiphany, 2 Thessalonians 2:8, revelation of the true Christ. And then the chain is clearly linked with darkness, with 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude 1:6, and impending judgment. The angel may represent a progression of circumstances rather than an artificial imposition of isolation on the part of God. And the binding in verse 2 flows naturally out of the previous events of the surrogate powers of this dragon, losing all power in their lake of fire, as well as everyone else also being infused with demonic domination, resulting in the destruction of all human life on earth. This would leave only the supernatural beings, demons, angels on this earth, with no humans to manipulate, deceive, or torment until another resurrection changes that situation. And here, this 1,000 years is mentioned 6 times in a row, which I think is highly significant.
I are you saying that the angel coming down from heaven is Christ and he has the key, but because he is the key?
Yeah, I think it could be both ways.
Okay.
He is the key. He was the one who went up and took the scroll because God was backed into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's holding the scroll and he can't open it. And nobody else can open it. So the Lamb is the key to opening the scroll and unlocking the legal conundrum that God finds himself in. In fact, the very idea of a Christ would parallel a key to unlock a situation.
So this is a vision John is seeing, and he's faithful in writing it down. It doesn't mean that this is literally what will happen, but is a word picture, possibly, of, you know, to me, the abyss and being bound here, bound in the abyss, is kind of like, okay, you've chosen Earth. Everybody's dead. You're bound here. You can't go anywhere else. These are the rules of engagement. Something to this effect. I mean, is that within the realm of interpretation?
I also wrote a few things that came to me on the abyss, which, again, I just found curious or compelling. Just an idea. This term often refers to chaos, sometimes describing the aftermath from devastation or war. It's the same term used to describe the chaotic condition of this planet just before its makeover in Genesis 1 and 2. Now, personally, I find a lot of credibility that that description of chaos before creation of this world, or what I call what do you call it? A rework, revamping, reformatting. Here we go.
Reformation, reform.
I see it as a transformation.
Yeah. That chaos, this is my opinion, was possibly due to Satan's previous attempts to create life through evolutionary methods, literally billions of years. And he found it easier just to convince us he did it than to actually do it. From that perspective, the dark abyss could refer cosmically to this world. So this world could be the abyss where Satan has concentrated his dark lies and violent revolt against heaven, which in contrast is heaven, which in contrast is the source of all light. It's almost like this world was turned into the great spiritual black hole of the universe, in contrast to the temple in heaven, and God's throne is the great spiritual quasar of the universe.
Well, this is like, because we get it, I think it's in Revelation or someplace in the narrative of the great controversy is at the cross or after the cross, the idea that the councils of the universe would no longer listen to the adversary,
Yes.
and there was no room in the heavenly councils, whatever you want to say. So the binding seemed to start there.
It's a progressive.
There's nowhere for him to go
Yeah.
because no one, they just put up the hand and go, no, not even, don't know. So there's nowhere for him to go. So it's a natural consequence. Christ, to me, I love the idea that Christ is the key, and the incarnation, perhaps, of Christ is the key. In the full revelation of the controversy, and that it reveals, unmasks the adversary, so that the binding begins. And it's not the first death in Revelation. I think we get it somewhere there. There's nobody alive on earth for 1,000 years.
That's right here.
So, yeah, and that is what seems like not able to deceive the nations because, well, they're not
They don't
around.
exist. They're not hearing you. They're dead.
Right. And you've killed them, basically, is.
Yes, which is in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, is you killed your own people.
I see this fitting with Genesis 1 and 2, or 1 verse 1 and 2, because the word. There's not just the darkness. There's the deep. And the deep is watery, a watery waste.
The deep things of Satan.
And it is, the word is Tehom, which is related to the word Tiamat.
Would it also be related to tomb?
How do you spell that?
TOMB.
No. No, tomb isn't Hebrew. I'm using Hebrew.
Yeah.
It's to home, as in Tiamat. So I see that as related to, and Tiamat is the parallel or the equivalent in Job 38, I mean, Job 41 to Sasatan.
The king of pride.
He is king over all the sons of pride. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the last word
Yeah.
of Job 41.
when that discussion started animating the thoughts, and then when I was thinking about, because it's clearly related to Genesis 1, I said, wait a minute, that's when the word came down, and with his word contained and completely reformatted the chaos into perfect organization, beauty, functionality, perfection, joy, peace, everything. The ultimate, nirvana, whatever. And it came out of the chaos. So it was the exact opposite of the chaos. You got light out of darkness. And the first few verses in there, it's fascinating how many times that it keeps saying he divided, he divided, he divided.
So separation is a key term
Yes.
in Genesis 1 and 2, mostly Genesis 1.
Which would imply that something needed to be divided that previously was amalgamated or whatever you want to call it. And he was coming down and undoing the chaos by separating things that needed to be separated.
Well, it also gives us a word picture of the separation between light and dark, between God and an adversary.
Yes. Because the confusion is he was painting God out to be both good and evil, both light and dark. He's blurring everything. And so the word says, no, there is a distinction. There's a clear distinction. In fact, there is no harmony between the two. And there's no balance between the two either.
So in Revelation, is this in a sense then a with the binding in that is we've seen coming in chaos increasing and allowed to increase. So at this point, the light has withdrawn and allowed the chaos to reign again. And with the adversaries unmasking, the binding has become complete. No one will, there's nowhere to go but live in the chaos he's created.
And I don't, I would think to extrapolate this as symbols out into more literal application, this angel coming down out of heaven, if it's Christ, which I think it is, if he is the key, he holds the key, he is the key. Part of the reason he's the key is because he is now human. So he is the legitimate representative of all humanity, and Satan is not. He used to be, well, he never was legitimate, but he used to claim to be a representative. Now he is not. So Christ is the key because he is humanity's representative. Therefore, he is coming to the world of humanity and exercising his authority as a human being, as their representative. And because everybody's dead, because Satan has slain his own people, it's the circumstances that bind him. His very presence of light, the dark, those who love darkness hate the light. And since there's no human beings left, his second coming, which I think is what it's talking about, coming down out of heaven, I think is the second coming.
I see. Okay.
He comes and removes his people from the earth. Everybody else self-destructs. I don't think he destroys them. He doesn't destroy anybody.
Right.
They self-destruct, leaving him bound.
Because the rest of the universe now is able to be in Shekinah glory.
And the idea of chain, and I didn't write that down, but I thought it'd be interesting to at least, and I don't know if that literally is chain. In fact, I think Anna mentioned when she looked it up that it could also literally mean, I did. I wrote it down. It could also mean manacles or bonds. So it's not necessarily specifically a chain, more as it is a means of restraint. So the idea, if it was specifically a chain is a whole series of interlocking circles. And that could extrapolate all kinds of meanings of not just a single thing, but a whole series of interlocking circumstances that end up binding him. And I think there may be some credibility to that extrapolation as well. And he forged his own chains, in essence.
Correct, yeah.
And even though it says the angel did it, as in a lot of things in the Bible where it says God did it, God literally allowed circumstances to develop where he, in essence, bound himself, put backed himself into a corner, and then God leaves him there for 1,000 years.
Well, he certainly has done that in the destruction. The wicked are destroyed by the brightness of Jesus coming, so they're not alive. There's no one around for him to tempt or deceive. And he has nothing but a wilderness waste of darkness. It's like the return to Genesis 1.
Yes.
Interestingly, the sealing of, don't think it's incidental, the sealing of Satan in the abyss, I think parallels Matthew 27:66. So they went with the guard and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone. They sealed his body in an abyss, darkness. And that seal, in our parlance, I grew up with these Bible stories and all that stuff, some kind of wax seal. It's like, no, they have literally found that seal, the actual one. And it was a very advanced refinement of iron or steel, like rebar. And it was literally bored into the bedrock. And it was a big round stone. They rolled it in a channel up against another wall. And then they put this iron, very highly hardened iron rod, and embedded it right into the rock, sticking out so the stone could not move at all. And you would have to break that large iron rod in the bedrock to be able to move that stone. And then when the angel came, he just snapped it off like a toothpick and tossed the stone over on the hillside, which they found. And they actually took samples because they found where it snapped off in the bedrock. And they took samples of it and lab tested it. And they were amazed that it seemed very advanced mixture of metal. It was very tough steel. And that's what it meant by sealing it. It was literally locked shut with that iron rod. And so now, like what goes around comes around. Now he's sealed.
But I don't think it was a literal seal. Was it any more than it was a literal chain?
Well, you have the rod of iron in chapter 19.
The rod of iron, yes, but is that literal?
No, it's not, nothing in Revelation is literal. What I'm saying, though, is that Satan basically sealed Jesus in the tomb, literally, but
Yes.
also figuratively. And then he came out, with an angel, snapped it off and called him out. So now Satan finds himself being put into a quote tomb, and it's sealed. So the very same sequence of events is happening to him, except he can't get out.
Well, and it's all self-induced
Yeah.
because the universe ultimately is restored
Yeah.
and Earth is yet to be the last bit restored.
And that's what we see in Isaiah, I think, is it says all the earth is quiet.
Well, there's nothing there.
And you have gone down to the grave, except the grave's not going to accept you. But that whole phrase is like, wait, that's 1,000 years. And then it says all the kings rise up and they're like, oh, is this the man? Well, that could be at the resurrection. This is the guy that did all this stuff.
Well, it's returned to the chaos state Satan had it in the beginning. He's gone nowhere.
Right. And then he gets to live in his own chaos.
Yeah.
So, does I'm kind of curious, I don't want to move on unless, but it brings to me a natural question, which is with that 1,000 years, does the natural, what God had put in place for the earth, in Cameroon, if you didn't cut the jungle back around us, it would not take 1,000 years and you'd be jungle again. It would be 20 years, if that. And I'm wondering if the natural healing that God put in place would, over that 1,000 years, become restorative in a sense, unless the adversary can't handle that and wants to keep destroying it. But it seems like there's got to be something there when people come back to life before Armageddon. And am I confusing myself here unnecessarily?
No, I love those kind of questions. That's what I ask for years and years. And there's a lot of questions. For instance, I mean, logical, literal, physical questions. If every human being who has ever lived on the face of the earth for 6,000 years is all alive at the same time, which apparently they are,
Where do we
with
fit?
maybe a few slight exceptions, that's a lot of people, including before the flood. That's a lot of people. And I believe that the flood caused a whole lot of water that we now have in oceans that wasn't there before or wasn't taking up space on the surface. I easily foresee that God allows, and he's going to be working behind the scenes during the millennium. Again, reformatting the earth, but not necessarily making it beautiful, but maybe allowing volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, massive type, shifts in tectonic plates and everything, so that a lot of that water may again be underneath the crust of the earth and much more land space is available. And then, given time, I mean, 1,000 years is a long time for plants. And all that stuff starts growing back so that at the resurrection, there's plenty of room for everybody.
Assuming, I keep, the hope, I think how lovely it would be that in the grand scheme, people have chosen God, although I think the narrative gives us the idea that there are quite a few who have not, they've preferred to trust the devil. And so how many would be left? But obviously we're talking throughout time. So anyway. That's an aside to the whole conversation of who's lost and saved.
But whether they're lost or saved, they're still all alive there.
Well, that's true at the second coming because the kingdom comes down and
The third coming.
sorry, at the third coming. Yes. Third coming. Thank you for that correction. Third coming is what I had in mind. Kingdom comes down.
And when we get to the city, I'm completely convinced because everything in Revelation is symbolic, is my stock criteria. I believe the holy city is people. It's the people of God. We are the temple of God. I mean, I believe is a description. I mean, even the language used, you know, the gates are, you know, the 12 tribes.
Tribes. Yeah.
The foundation is 12 apostles. You're using humans to describe a physical building. That's completely contradictory if you're trying to make it physical to start with. And I think even Ellen White makes a very interesting reference someplace that she calls believers light emitting stones that compose the temple of God. Which, you know what a light emitting stone is? Obviously, she wouldn't have known. So she calls a light emitting stone. Now we call them LEDs. That's a light emitting stone, a diode. And they're everywhere, and we're using them, you know, and we're enamored with it. Wow, they're really bright. Well, God knew that. And the whole temple is light emitting stones, all different colors. I mean, all that stuff. I believe the holy city is describing the people in some sort of dimension that we don't yet thoroughly unpack, but because I view it as symbolic, that doesn't preclude that there could be some sort of physical habitation, but everything has to be approached symbolically first and unpacked symbolically. And then it's just incidental if it happens to also include physical. So if you have a city full of people and even the dimensions, I think even the numbers are symbolic, personally. If you translate the numbers literally, which I don't think is a good idea, you end up with, what is it, 360 miles square or something, which becomes real problematic if you try to make it literal, because it's 360 miles high, which is quite a bit into outer space.
It's the Borg cube for our sci-fi fans.
Well, it could also be a pyramid.
Yeah, well, that's a
There's
good.
good evidence that it's a pyramid, because it can be square and still be a pyramid. And pyramids actually do have metaphysical properties unlike any other shape. In fact, I think one of the great pyramids I've heard has literally named the places and locations inside the pyramid, and everything are named in stuff that's shown us up in Revelation. It's pretty stunning. There's like a channel that goes up. There's one that goes down, and it's uncanny. The names of the caverns and the stairways and the locations and stuff, and it's like, oh, how did they know, kind of thing.
So have we answered the key in the chain pretty well at this point?
I just threw out my ideas.
Well, I'm, you know, again, I appreciate and resonate with Revelation as symbolic first. And it seems reasonable that in the context of the biblical narrative from creation to revelation, Satan is oriented to chaos and destruction. And that with the incarnation, to me, that's the key, is incarnation. And you've articulated as Christ in human form. And for me, it's everything about that incarnation, the revelation of who God is, the revelation of humanity, the revelation of the adversary. Gene, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's all right. I was going to say that to me, this is the parallel to the angel that comes down from heaven at the end of the final movement. And if you adopt the rise of the Advent movement in terms of Revelation 10, he's the angel who comes down. to start that movement.
I could see a sequence of, if the abyss is chaos and you keep seeing containment, release, containment, release, containment, release as a pattern. And so Satan starts a war in heaven. Actually, I think Michael started it. Satan caused it. And chaos erupts, which spills over to this earth. And the result we see at the beginning of creation is chaos. So chaos is released. And then the Godhead comes down and contains it with the creation activity and demonstrates how God uses power, which has opposite results to Satan's power. And then with the fall, chaos is again released, which results later in the flood. And when you get down to the time of Christ, the chaos just is getting worse and worse. And the angel comes down from heaven, Christ comes down from heaven in the incarnation and brings light, which causes judgment. So he's addressing the chaotic views of God that have blinded everyone on earth to the kind of God he is. And so this overwhelming flood of light of the truth about God's disposition and character causes a massive containment of the lies, and especially in the universe. You know, every lingering sympathy with Satan is gone. It's evaporated, never again. So that made a huge difference in the rest of the universe. Satan immediately goes to work to create chaos about what the cross even means. And we're living with the after effects of that. So now chaos is released again. In Revelation 9, which could be a metaphor of a number of these, Satan releases intensive chaos. The whole chapter is massive chaos, which I think is actually relevant to today's events, until the second coming, when the chaos is completely maximized to the point of complete polarization of the entire planet. And then Christ comes down again from heaven as a human being, also God, and brings an end to that chaos. So he contains chaos again. But at the end of the millennium, and it says it must happen, he must be released, again, chaos is released. And he goes out to deceive the whole world. Gog and Magog, all that stuff we haven't even looked at yet. So you got these sequences of chaos released, chaos contained, chaos released, chaos contained. Even the end of the millennium, it's chaos released again. But I think that's the last time it's released, because it's important that everyone be alive at the same time, so there's no questions of doubts about what was past or forward or anything. Everything is now in the present. Everyone is living in the present. There's no possibility for doubts about, well, what did they mean? Go talk to them. They're right there. Okay. Everybody's alive. All possible venues for doubt or distrust or lies is eroded. And that's the only way that the final day of judgment, which God's the one being judged, can be fully carried out by the full revelation of truth, which is the final containment of chaos permanently for all eternity. And God has to do it in this sequence. And I mean, a person could analyze each one of those and say, what part, what was contained in each one of these containments? Because it seemed they have to build on each other, and they have to build on each other until you get to the final containment, which is never done with coercion or pressure. It's always done through revelation. And the greatest revelation is when the fire comes down out of heaven. Again, totally symbolic, but highly significant, because that is the greatest revelation of the truth about God, the total revelation of the truth about God that becomes undeniable. And then our reaction to that revelation, that fire, is self-enforcing.
We live or we die.
It either ushers us into the greatest ecstasy ever known, or it ushers us into the greatest allergic reaction of torment. And but we're still, everyone's still free to live as long as they want. And I think that explains why some live longer than others, because some are more stubborn and they're willing to live in torment because they are in God's, nobody's killing them. They can live as long as they want and they finally get tired of it. The ones that don't want to live. And I think it's important. I think that is the most important one, because God has to be exonerated entirely, that he has no complicity in anyone's death, that they choose death for themselves. And without that, the universe is never secure. And years ago, when I was reading the Old Testament prophets, and I used to hate reading them because it was so depressing and vague and everything. So I started speed reading them, and I found out, wow, you can learn some really good stuff speed reading to get more perspective. And I began noticing this pattern over and over, repeated, like in Isaiah and Jeremiah. And it was like there was a local situation God wanted to talk about. So he'd come down and he would start giving the prophet a message about, I don't know, whatever it was. That's the oblique part, is you're trying to figure out what the context is. You know what? It doesn't really matter, maybe, because God's one of those talkers that always steers everything back to his favorite topic. And I noticed, he's talking about some country or some sin or something, but then he would spin it around and it started getting more and more seemingly irrelevant to the local situation. And it started sounding more and more familiar. Like, wait, he said this who knows how many times before. Why does he keep going back to this subject? And so I started looking at those patterns and like, oh, God is like obsessed with the day of judgment. And when you're not afraid of the day of judgment, now you can actually look at it, with an open mind and say, well, why would he be so obsessed with it? Because he's not out there to kill everybody. Why is he so excited about talking about it obsessively in every discussion? Well, because that's when it's over. I mean, wouldn't we be excited when it's all over and it never happen again? And God's exonerated and everybody's free to live or die, whatever they want to do. I mean, he's excited about that and he wants to talk about it all the time. And so we get here, and now we're actually seeing prophetically sort of how it plays out.
I'd like to add to that comment, Floyd, that God gets excited about it because it clearly shows how Satan has misaligned his character and will ensure that sin will never come back because we would never choose it again. So pulling it back yet further, it gives us a knowledge that we didn't have before.
And it's the restoration of intimacy with his children, as many as were willing,
Yes.
which is what he's craved from the very beginning of creation.
Freedom of choice.
He's not just in it to vindicate himself, but that has to happen to secure a kingdom of love with no fear.
Yes.
But that could be self-serving. It's like he's looking forward to the wedding night. Good grief. It's like he's more excited about it than any human's ever been. He wants the full restoration of all the intimacy possible. And that means for the joy set before him, he endured all this, despised the shame, Because all through the last hours, he had been saying, I want to be with you. I want you to be with me. I can't wait to be with you. The whole purpose of everything is I want to be together. And that's going to happen fully at the end of the 1100 years.
Do you think that when Satan's bound, that there's a parallel 1,000 years? There's the 1,000 years that the saints reign in heaven with God, and there's a 1,000 years Satan's bound. Do you think he can be aware, like have some kind of television screen, what is going on with the saints so that he's more
Never
tormented by it?
thought
There's nothing that suggests that. It's just, it would be purely speculation, I'm afraid.
Well, on that level, I like that idea because it further illustrates the his unmasking, or there's nowhere to hide as the truth of everything is understood, including why people are there who we are surprised at, and why people aren't there who we are surprised at. And we can see how they trusted him, the adversary, or how they had trusted God. And for the adversary to see that, I think would be profound, so that that's accomplished before the return.
Yeah, it's just hard to know, but it's curious. You have this perfect parallels that obviously are at the same time. They're synchronous.
And he can't manipulate the questions or the answers. He's bound to not be able to do anything about it.
He can't deal with it. He can't do anything about it.
He can't access them. Correct.
No.
I think that's poetic.
I need some insight as to what the believers will be doing during that 1,000 years. When I joined the church, what I was told is that they were going to be judging those who had died and passing on judgment as to what was to happen to them.
And crafting how long they have to
Yes,
burn. Remember
exactly.
that? Oh,
Can I tell
wow.
you that didn't make me feel too comfortable?
No.
Okay, so what is it that they are actually doing during that 1,000 years?
I think they're coming to understand why some are there and some are not.
Okay.
I think that's a small part of it.
This is, yeah, it could be, but at least that.
I'm on cloud nine playing my harp at least 2 hours a day. Sorry, I just had to step in and
You like playing a harp, do
oh no, it doesn't. It could be anything, a piccolo, whatever. No, I do, I think there's growth for each of us to do, because no matter how much
Yes.
we think we understand the big picture, the big view, the larger view, the great controversy. And the one who just, said, Lord, remember me on the cross.
Right, exactly.
We are not that far apart. We've got a lot to learn.
Yes.
Yes.
So we might be learning musical instruments, but I think that's a waste of the time of those 1,000 years. The real, there's going to be time forever to do some of those things. But no, I think growth, we could profess as Christians,
Maturing.
but maturity, yes, growth, maturity,
Yeah.
where we trust, but we maybe aren't the safest ones to be around yet. And during that 1,000 years, we are secured in such trusting ways that while the learning goes on forever, enough learning happened that there is at least no malice in any, all of the growth, that maturity that's had to happen has happened, and we really are safe to be let loose in the universe. I don't know.
I fully agree with that. In fact, I have some probably scandalous ideas of what I think is going to happen. It could easily get me in trouble or dismissed as an idiot. I think too much, I guess. And I take a lot of these statements that I grew up with and I reframe them and put them back together and say, okay, how might these contribute? I mean, the Bible talks about growing up as calves in the stall. So there's definitely growing. Why is there leaves that are for healing if there's no healing taking place? And if there's healing to take place, and this is where I butt heads with a very famous, well-known teacher today. Again, Ellen White says that upon resurrection, the train of thoughts, and she's talking about the lost, but I think it applies to everybody. The train of thoughts pick up exactly where they left off. Nothing has changed except they're alive with a functioning body again. And their character is exactly the way as it went into the grave. Well, okay, I think that's a principle of freedom. Freedom applies to everybody. So if the thief on the cross, with all of his presumed wrong-headed thinking and habitual reactions and all that triggers or whatever, I mean, you can pick him or anybody. If they're resurrected, is it suddenly they're all gone? Are they magically gone? And unfortunately, some people teach that. And I've butted heads with them.
Okay, can't remember anything.
God wins on evidence. This is I'm like, suddenly you're magically changed and it's magical thinking. And I'm like, but there's nothing about this whole thing God's done ever that seems magical. I mean, we could go to creation 6 days, whatever, but the idea of transformation has never been magical.
No, the magic as Gene unpacked so well many years ago, is the suspension of the principle of cause and effect. It's bypassing cause and effect. It's you can do something and then something completely irrelevant just happens. And there's the only cause is I said the magic words. And that's actually what our whole world has come to now is, the suspension of cause and effect. Whereas I think upon resurrection, now I may be stretching it, I could be corrected, but they better have a good argument. I believe everybody, because of the principle of freedom, it's essential that the principle of freedom never be tampered with. So if I'm resurrected and I had triggers, but the direction of my life was God saw that I'm headed the right direction and I'm salvageable. And so I wake up in the resurrection, and yeah, sure, it's joy, and wow, we get to fly and we go to heaven and all that stuff. But then I get up to heaven. Okay, I'm assigned two or three minders. You know what a minder is, right? Because I'm not safe. Okay. And I don't need to be breaking jars and who knows what, making a mess. But the minders are very kind. But they also know my triggers. They probably know me. They knew me my whole life. And so when I'm about to get triggered by some situation, by another person, and the minders are reminding me of my true identity, and the growth and the healing will be exponentially faster because but the triggers are still there and they need to come out in the open and they need to be healed. They could be done in seconds instead of, years.
Well, there's nobody poking the, there's no one, the adversary's not there poking it.
And he's not creating new ones. But I think it's important that character must be developed by the person themselves in their own choices. And this teacher insists, and I'm like, what? And he said, because I challenged him on it. And he said, well, because they believed in Jesus, then God has permission while they're dead to go in and tamper with the records of
Ooh.
their life or their brain and everything, so that when they get a new brain on the resurrection, all those triggers are resolved because he has permission. I'm like, no, that's not freedom.
I want permission.
Tampering with the evidence, tampering with the character is artificial, and I just can't buy it. I just can't buy it. No, I think the person themselves has to mature.
Right, a natural process.
The only thing I would interject is that people with mental illnesses will be healed at resurrection.
I agree. I agree. In fact, I think they're going to be the ones put in charge of teaching the rest of us how to act like ourselves.
I just, because I have been blessed with a family history of this, and I share that history, my mother would not have behaved in certain ways if she had not had that illness. And so, and my grandfather, for example, I expect him to be a very different person when he's risen from the grave because he won't have that giant cloud of depression.
Yeah. So that to me is a physical healing.
Right. I don't have any problem with that.
Physical healing, and it does affect the mind.
I'm talking about character traits.
I agree that everything that happens has to be done in the highest freedom.
Yes. Above board.
There can be nothing, no cheating.
Right,
To me,
right.
that scenario he painted was one of cheating.
That's how I feel.
You're messing with them.
Yeah.
Did I give you permission to do that? You know?
Well, but even there's something about being conscious of transformation that is freedom and participative. And again, if God's winning on evidence, it seems reasonable to say the evidence of my life consciously in my choices and decisions is of paramount importance to the security of the universe forever. Otherwise, it seems, again, maybe the right word is cheating or shortcutting. And, I suppose if I get there and find out, okay, fine, but I'm one who loves process, so
That's the P.
fair point. I am an
That's not a J.
ENFP. Yeah, I'm not a J. I like process.
I understand where the objection's coming from, however. I have to respect that. I don't agree, but the pushback is because of the insistence, one of our traditions, that there can be no sin in heaven. Therefore, everybody has to be completely sinless to be in that atmosphere or whatever. And I'm like, then why are there healing leaves if there's no problem? And it turns into an arbitrary God who's going to punish sinners. And if we find one little discrepancy in your life, oops, how'd you get in here? No, I think the growth is going to happen very rapidly because it's going to be in a pristine environment where love and joy and humility and vulnerability and everything are completely in vogue. And yeah, but it still needs to happen.
Yeah, and I was going to say there's a the conversation of what is sin, and
Exactly.
yeah,
Exactly.
exactly.
if we
Yeah.
say there's no
Breach of
sin,
trust.
I would start with there's no rebellion.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
So those who are his trusting friends aren't in rebellion
Right.
to the process or the transformation.
But they do have inbuilt triggers, automatic responses to circumstances, and I think it will be delightful to deal with. I mean, it is right now. I'm finding myself in situations where I know I would be triggered. Like just a few weeks ago, I went to a Sabbath school class, and what was happening there, all the way up till now, would have been very triggering, and I wasn't triggered. And I was sitting there in absolute amazement that I wasn't being triggered. Because for my whole life, I would have been triggered by this. And now I can see it from a mature standpoint, and I actually feel compassion for these people.
Different perspective.
Okay, I had a similar thing happen. And like you say, Floyd, it can happen very quickly, the healing part. When I was 13, did I tell this story?
Probably, but you can tell it again. How
It's
do we
another
know? We haven't heard it
context.
yet.
I'm granted the privilege because
Go
I'm 68. No.
for it.
When I was 13, I lived in on Academy campus, Laurelwood Academy, and there was a story I was told that happened on that campus in the boys' dorm. Some guys were messing around at night and goofing off, and I don't know what they were doing, and that part was never told, and I don't think anybody knew. But there was a hole in the wall that had somehow gotten there. And it had broken the plaster. It hadn't broken the studs or anything, but it had broken the plaster. And all of a sudden, a voice came from the wall. "Who do you think I am?" And one of the guys said, "Oh, probably the devil." He said, "You're right." The voice said, "You're right." And that night, a majorly tall being came into the room of that student who had said that. And tried to choke his out his life. He managed to utter the word Jesus, and the being left. His roommate was from Japan and was just devastated because he had left Japan thinking he would never meet that on an academy campus in the United States. And fortunately, his English teacher took him under her wing and brought him home. And he was able to stay with her the rest of his senior year. I was terribly upset over that story because there was no Ouija board that I knew about. There was no, there was nothing, no cause. And I've always been a very cause and effect person. And so I kept trying to figure this out, and I became deathly afraid of Satan. And just deathly afraid. I wouldn't stay in a room if he was being talked about. I wouldn't, I didn't want anything to do with him. But my fears began to invade my peace of mind and cause some problems in that. I just managed to isolate myself from the topic and not to think about it. And then we moved away from Laurelwood to Arizona, and I was sitting in a classroom in my freshman year of academy. This was now after my conversion experience. So I'd had my conversion experience when I was 14. And now at 15, I was sitting in this classroom with my Bible teacher, and he started telling a story after story about Satan. Appearance or something demonic happening in Puerto Rico where he'd been as a student missionary. And I sat through the whole class, heard every story, and wasn't triggered. I remember walking out of the classroom thinking, I never got afraid. I wasn't afraid. And I knew it was because of the picture of God I now had. Perfect love casts out fear. And as long as you know the perfect God, you have that perfect love. I have had encounters dealing with Satan. And the thing he knows is that I'm not afraid of him. They weren't visual, they were impression-like. But I have told him a thing or two on occasion. And not been triggered. Not afraid. And I think that's an example of kinds of things that will happen in the hereafter when we are no longer, when we no, when all our fears are gone, because we're in a perfect atmosphere of love and truth. And we know we're safe. that safe feeling because nothing will hurt us deliberately or intentionally there. I think that, like Floyd says, the turnaround is going to be very rapid.
And understanding, I think part of that exploration for that 1,000 years is understanding how all of the stories fit together to reveal this huge tapestry that we would call the Great Controversy. I've read the narrative and I've lived my reality, but I get to. I mean, I think that's for eternity, but I think there's an amount that needs to happen
Integration.
to that in that 1,000 years. And that is, I think, about all the different walks of life that people are coming from. And I think a good word is integration, where we are not identical, but we're coming to understand a common story that's bigger than all of us. That takes time. And questions, and it's going to be forever, but there needs to be a level.
Don't you think that we'll be talking to angels a lot and hearing their story of how this whole thing happened?
Yeah, I think for me, that's going to be eternal, everlasting, but there is still a level with which, okay, guys, we've got some assignments. Bill's a process guy, so let's get him talking to people. Asking appreciative questions about their experience with God as they know him, because he's trying to put this picture together. I come with just the small one, but I just know that there, and it's again just enough for that integration. And then, man, I'm going to explore it, planets around the universe for eternity.
Yeah, that's after the millennium, I think.
Correct. Correct. Oh, yes.
I think the millennium is going to be very.
It's the investigative judgment that we are, did God do what he could
To save my loved one.
for my, yeah, and I've trusted him, but now I need to explore that trust and settle it in a mature way.
I also believe even more so that this is the time of integration for every human being who composes the body of Christ to be knitted into their niche in that body. And clearly, a body is made up of all different kinds of cells and sites and organs and everything. And we're going to find people from throughout history that we resonate with. And we discover that we're all heart muscles, or we're all fingernails or whatever. But it's like, oh, hey, wow, you think just like me and you lived 3,000 years ago. And we're comparing notes and we become instant friends. And they're the bonding process, the joy bonding process of knitting. Just like our body does. The healing is the integration of cells coming into alignment and attaching tightly with each other, and all the cells, the interacting cells all around them that are, some of them are different. You got cells right next to the bone cells, but they're not bone cells. They're something else, but they know exactly where they fit. And then you've got the nervous system. You got Our body is literally the symbol of what that's going to look like on a huge scale, which is the body of Christ. And the head is the one synchronizing this whole process. And it's not going to happen on day two. It takes a full 1,000 years for us to be fully knit together, bonded, integrated, and synchronized in perfect synchronization with the head before the end of the 1,000 years, when this body, now fully synchronized and pulsing in harmony with the head, is ready to watch the trauma of the other body being resurrected and it gets assembled And it becomes unified in all of its ugliness. And then the two bodies are compared and saying, here is the full fruit of Satan's form of reality and kingdom building. Here is the full fruit of the Lamb's kingdom and body building. And now, for all eternity, the visual of those two bodies and the stark contrast between those, and both bodies have to be allowed to fully mature, fully mature. So that's why I think it takes 100 years for Satan's body to fully integrate and mature and harden their hearts completely to be just as much in rebellion as Satan is. But it takes 1,000 years for the saints to fully soften and melt and weld together in the metamorphosis so that the butterfly comes out forever to fly.
I was going to say, using our own language on ourselves here, the 1,000 years is a metaphor for as long as it takes to solidify everyone.
I like that.
I'm not, and it doesn't conflict with, I'm just having some fun with using our own words. But I think that is not a but. And I think the contrast between the body of Christ and the body of the adversary is profound for the universe to see.
So I did a little math calculation. I don't actually believe it, but I like to look at all the options. Because, we've had this tradition that prophetic times are prophetic time, right? So if you're going to insist that everything's symbolic, then why are we saying the 1,000 years is not symbolic?
Yes, that was my question, basically.
And so I said, okay, let me do the math. Day for a year principle, right? And a Jewish year is 360 days. So how many years is that? 360 million years. So what?
I know, goes by in a blink. And here for me, because of my recent appreciation, renewal appreciation of Hebrews, what, 4:6, there remains a rest for God's people today. And I love the idea that 6,000 years in narrative time leading to 1,000 years of rest. Away from coercion and force and tyranny and abuse. I just, for me, there's the poetry and symmetry in this millennial story of rest.
Okay, I that doesn't make sense what I just said.
Oh, day for a year, 360,000 years.
I'm going to have to go on record to correct myself. It would be 360,000, right? A day for a year. Wait, but there's 1,000 years. That's where the other 1,000 comes from.
There you go. Yes, you're multiplying.
So, yeah, 1 year would be 360,000. 1,000 years is 360 million. I was right. So now we know.
And it has rocked my world. Oh, wait, yes, no.
I don't think we're going to care.
That's what I was going to say. That's probably a larger truth to that. And again, I love how we in this group have said God will go for as long as it takes for his people to, or for the revelation of the enemy to be seen. So I think that's an important aspect, and certainly there's an influence God has in removing protection and other things to not manipulate, but to provide opportunities for that revelation of growth and change. But it really is about not wanting any to be lost, and in the process, everyone comes to make their decision.
So, looking ahead, because it's 5:02.
Yes, it is. Okay, thank you, Jean.
Where are we leaving off today?
Well, I want to inject one more thing, if about the 1,000 years. I also agree with Keith that many, if not all, of the numbers in Revelation are also symbolic, more than literal. And this and the meaning and numbers have meanings, very specific meanings. And he has concluded, and I agree with him, that the number 1,000 gets its significance from the most holy place. Because the sanctuary, there's like thousands of numbers in the sanctuary. And those numbers and their location in the sanctuary and their function are how you figure out what the implications of a number are prophetically or symbolically, not prophetically. And I agree with him that the number 1,000 most likely, especially when you apply it everywhere and it seems to fit very well, the number 1,000 comes from the fact that the interior of the most holy place in this sanctuary is exactly 1,000 cubic numbers. Doesn't matter what you call it. You know, it's measured in cubits, so it's cubits. But it's not the actual length or space, it's the number itself. And so the volume of the most holy place is 1,000. What fills up the space of the most holy place? It's the presence of God. The Shekinah is now measurable in a square box, a perfectly cubed box. And that box is 1,000. So when you then take that and you go throughout history, and when 1,000 shows up very specifically, you say, okay, what if we replace the 1,000 with the presence of God and see how that fits? And it's pretty amazing what happens. And the same is true with a lot of other numbers.
Well, I do think the 1,000 years is about being in the presence in the most holy place,
Yes. Yeah.
in a sense.
Yeah, in my father's house are many rooms.
I'd say we pick it up at verse 4.
Chapter 20, verse 4.
Yeah. Because we could talk for a long time about thrones and judgment and
Okay,
guillotines.
I put a little mark in my Bible
Okay.
so I don't have to go asking and trying to figure it out
I'll
next week.
highlight it next week, and then I need to remember to unhighlight it. So, okay.
So let's bow our heads. Father in heaven, we thank you for being with us, and I ask that you will continue to lead us and guide us as we go through these remaining chapters of Revelation. May we never lose sight of the importance of keeping our focus on you, as we have here. We pray that you'll be with us this coming week and be with Brad and Nancy as they travel, keeping them safe. And we pray that you'll be with Anna, who struggles so much with her family issues. I pray that you will give her strength and courage and comfort as she continues her journey with them. Thank you for all the things you've done for us in this meeting today. In Jesus' name, amen.